It's nice to be here this morning and have an opportunity to speak with you. I do this about once every year, so I've got a year's worth of material. What time is it? Okay. My name's Malcolm, as Simon said, and I'm married to Lucy, who's just at the back right, closest to the door, so she can exit if our son starts screaming. So let me start this morning by reading some scripture. And this is from Ecclesiastes. And this is the moment where I'm on the spot trying to find the right book in the Bible. There it is. This is Ecclesiastes chapter 3. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to uproot. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to tear down, and a time to build. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones, and a time to gather them. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain. A time to search, and a time to give up. A time to keep, and a time to throw away. A time to tear, and a time to mend. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Some of you might remember a talk I gave here last year in May. The talk was entitled, Everyone Has a Place at the Table. And I've got a couple of images, photographs from last year. Maybe Jules could bring them up. And so we started the service with a big cairn of stones in the middle of the room. And each one of those stones represented our lives, one of our lives. And what I invited you to do was to collect a stone. And you sat with it through the service. And we reflected on who we are as people. And what our contribution is, what's our place at the table, what is it that we can bring that's unique and that matters. And you may notice that the stones are still here, they're just behind me at the cross. I'm not sure if there's quite as many as last year, but I think there are a few. And I want to use them again this morning, so what I'm going to invite you to do is to get up and just get the blood flowing a little bit, and go and collect a stone at the foot of the cross. It doesn't matter if it's the same one that you had last year, and then just come and find a seat again, and a different seat, and maybe a seat at the front, so that you can maybe sit beside someone you might not normally sit beside, or just have a different angle and a different perspective for the rest of the service. So we'll do this quickly. We've got a clock running. It is 3 minutes and 39 seconds. So can we do this before 5 minutes? There's the goal. Oh, wow. There are a lot more stones than I thought, or maybe fewer people. Okay, so you've got your stone. Let me see. Hold out your stone. All right. So this stone this morning, this represents your life. Okay, so you've literally got your life in your hands this morning. And I want to ask you a question this morning. And the question is this. What season are you in? What season are you in? We heard in Ecclesiastes that there is a time for everything. So what season, what time are you in? We live in a world of continuous change. By the time I finish this talk, the planet that we're on right now will have traveled 34,000 miles through space. Now, can anyone work out how long I'm going to talk for? The sun will have produced the same amount of energy as if every human on the planet had their own 60-watt light bulb shining brightly for the rest of their lives. Before the end of the summer, whenever you think that might be, about 72% of your body will have been replaced three times over. The lining in your stomach and intestines will regenerate 10 times, your gums three times, your skin twice, and your liver once. Change is happening all the time. And a lot of that change is cyclical. On planet Earth, we're familiar with various cycles. Our planet orbits the sun once every 365 and a quarter days. And because of the tilt of the Earth, we experience in our country four seasons, if we're lucky: spring, summer, autumn, and winter. The moon orbits the Earth once every 27 days, and the Earth spins on its axis every 24 hours, resulting in a sunrise and a sunset, and two rising and falling tides every day. Our bodies are finely tuned to the rhythm of our day. In our culture and climate, most of us sleep once every 24 hours. I wish. In our days, years, and lifetimes, we experience cycles within cycles within cycles. Cycles of growing and receding, rising and falling. And these cycles aren't just on our planet, they can be found throughout the universe. Our solar system is one of billions of solar systems orbiting a supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. My favorite star is called Betelgeuse. It's in the Orion constellation, and it's known as a super red giant. It's about 5 million times bigger than the sun. And it's thought to be, in relative terms, close to the end of its life. So when a star dies, it uses up all its fuel, collapses in on itself, and the resulting supernova explosion forms many of the heavy elements that we have in our bodies and in this building, and they become the building blocks for new stars and new planets. And those elements that are made up of atoms and quarks, science tells us these very smallest particles are constantly moving. Matter looks stationary to the human eye. This lectern, this microphone, this building are stacked full of particles that never stand still. We know that when a tree sheds its leaves, new ones will return. When daffodils lose their blossom in early spring, they will retreat as the days get darker and colder, only to come back alive and well the following year. We are surrounded by and live within cycles of growing and receding, rising and falling, living and dying. We are surrounded by and live within transformation. But what has this got to do with you and me on the morning of the 16th of July, 2017. As a teenager, I went to summer camps every year. As most of you parents will know, it's good to take opportunities to send your kids off in the summer. I was sent off to camp, and I went to a camp run by the Scripture Union every summer. And for about 3 years, I went to one in the west of Ireland. And it was this beautiful peninsula in Donegal with these undulating sand dunes and dry grasses. We had an incredible time. We would swim in the sea every morning. We'd play on the beach throughout the day. And in the evenings, we'd get together and we'd hear about this person called Jesus. And I heard about someone who loved me despite my shortcomings, someone who welcomed home a lost son as depicted in the Rembrandt painting that we have behind me. I remember at the age of 15 singing a song much like the songs we sang this morning, stretching out my arms and experiencing a profound sense of belonging. And I also remember being taught and learning that the goal of this Christian life was to become like Jesus. And Jesus was perfect. He was flawless. He was sinless. So for me, that meant the goal of my life was to become perfect, to become flawless. Around this time, you might remember the wristbands that said WWJD on them. I haven't seen one of those for a long time. WWJD, which stood for What Would Jesus Do? And they were very popular amongst a generation of young Christians who were trying to live up to this ideal. But I couldn't reconcile this seeming paradox of, on one hand, complete acceptance and welcome, and on the other, this need to change, and not just change, but be perfect. And I applied my greatest efforts to become Jesus 2.0. I probably ended up a bit more like Malcolm 0.2. Amidst what can probably be described as a cocktail of sexual awakening and ego fragility that happens in a teenage male, I quickly became stuck in a negative cycle of zealous heavenly ambition and messy earthly reality. I hid in shame, praying, "Just one more chance, God. I'll never do it again. I'll get it right next time." I wanted to change, to transform, to become someone else, but I kept failing. Transformation isn't a word that we use very often, I don't think. I think we're more familiar and more comfortable with a similar but quite different word, growth. And growth implies a steady increase, becoming gradually bigger and better as time goes on. I've worked in the transportation industry for the last 14 years or so, and I've done some time in the private and public sectors. And during a time when I was working at Transport Scotland and involved in some big projects around transport in Scotland, it dawned on me that the driving force behind the decision-making on these projects was economic growth. And that might sound really obvious to some of you, but I'd never really thought about it before until I was there. And I think that's the driving force behind all industries in Western economies. I expect most of us here are residents of Scotland. I wonder how many of you know the Scottish government's purpose. Would anyone like to have a flick? We're all looking at you. This is the Scottish government's purpose: to focus government and public services on creating a more successful country with opportunities for all of Scotland to flourish through increasing sustainable economic growth. Now, I love that part in there, opportunities for all of Scotland to flourish. But it strikes me that increasing sustainable economic growth is an oxymoron, a logical impossibility on a planet with finite resources. If our economy is based on the need for growth, then the implication is that our lives must be based on the need for growth. And if our lives are based on the need for growth, then our primary identity becomes that of a consumer. And it's an identity we're very familiar with. We may not notice it all the time, but we're faced with consumer choices every day. The food we eat, the clothes we wear, the technology we buy, the entertainment we watch, the house we live in, the political party we vote for, even the church we attend. The consumer says, "How can I get best value for my time and money? Or put another way, how can I get the most out and put the least in? And the message to the consumer from the billions of pounds spent by hyper-competitive organizations on marketing and advertising is this: consume and you will be fulfilled. Consume and you will be fulfilled. And this message plays on a fundamental aspect of the human condition, which is that at a deep core level, we don't feel like we're enough. Just like I felt as a teenager when I was trying to become like professional, world-class, pin-up, airbrushed Jesus. And the thing is, when it comes to not feeling like we're enough, I think that's actually true. I am not enough. You're not enough. Without family, friends, community, teachers, builders, engineers, doctors, nurses, farmers, coal miners, scientists, ministers, past and present, who would we be? But the illusion is this: if I consume, if I invest and secure my financial future, if I get that promotion, if I self-actuate into Super Malcolm with 20,000 Instagram followers, a New York Times bestseller, and a Golden Globe, I will be enough. I'll finally be secure and significant, and I won't need any of you. I wonder how much we've embraced this idea of continuous growth, which leads to consumption in one form or another. I wonder how much we've embraced this idea in our spiritual lives. We do talk about spiritual growth. How many people who lose faith and connection with the divine do so when the fast growth which comes with youthful zeal begins to fade? Overconsumption and the demand for individualized personal growth leaves us anxious, fatigued, judgmental, and ultimately alone. Bill Plotkin, who's a psychotherapist, and a lot of his work is using nature-based therapy. He writes about this brilliantly in one of his books. He says, "We live in a largely adolescent world. An adolescent world, being unnatural and unbalanced, inevitably spawns a variety of cultural pathologies, resulting in contemporary societies that are materialistic, greed-based, hostilely competitive, violent, racist, sexist, ageist, and ultimately self-destructive. These societal symptoms of patho-adolescence, which we see everywhere in the industrialized world today, are not at the root of our human nature, but rather an effect of egocentrism on our humanity." Does anyone think that sounds a bit familiar in 2017? And the thing is, in societies and in cultures like that, that are hyper-competitive, materialistic, greed-based, they're based on this growth. Who loses out? The elderly, the weak, the poor, the minorities, those who can't fight for themselves. My belief is, and I think it's captured in this quote, is that human transformation is the first necessary step to cultural or societal transformation. And transformation is different to growth. And the fundamental difference, I think, is this: transformation recognizes that death, loss, limitation is a necessary part of life. Richard Rohr says, the very activity we discern in the planets seems to be that through loss, crisis, stress, and limitation, we move into deeper states of consciousness and freedom. I think physicists today would say that actual loss is not real. Nothing totally dies. There is only transformation. So the common, you know, a metaphor we can use here is if we think about the water cycle, water changing from a liquid to a solid and then moving to a vapor and eventually back again. Each one looks like a death or a loss, but in fact it's a new becoming. And Richard Rohr says, we recognize that spiritual teachers were saying this all along, that dying must precede resurrection. Jesus, for Christians, became the icon and living image of that mystery. We're going to share bread and wine this morning, and one of the things we're going to do is recognize that the transformation that we're invited to in that, the inherent truth in the cycles of the universe and in the life of Christ, that dying must precede resurrection. And in many ways, this shouldn't be a surprise to us. Jesus said, take up your cross. We've got a cross at the back of our hall. That's not a common title of self-help books. He says, only when we die to ourselves, we'll live. When we lose our lives, we'll find them. When the disciples pleaded with Jesus, saying, give me a sign, essentially saying, show us that you're the biggest, you're the best, you're the most powerful, you're the Messiah, Jesus said, the only sign I will give you is the sign of Jonah. So what did he mean by that? Jonah, the story's quite familiar, I imagine, to most of us, was swallowed by a whale for 3 days, thrust into darkness, into powerlessness, into what must to him have felt like his death, later to be restored and changed forever. A prelude, perhaps, to the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ himself. How much time do we spend trying to grow into who we're meant to be, rather than to die into who we're meant to be? The pattern of behavior that I described when I was a teenager and a young man is not unusual. In fact, I would suggest that core feeling that we're not enough and should be bigger and better is epidemic in our society. As a counselor, and most of my experience is counseling other men, it's common to hear phrases like, I need to sort myself out, or I just have to deal with it. We want to sort ourselves out, independent from each other, to present a better version of ourselves back to the world. I think we're deeply afraid that if others knew who I really was, what I'm really like, what I was really thinking, I would be rejected and alone. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is in John, and it says, one day you will know as you are now known. And I think we have such a deep longing to be known, but it's also one of the things we're most afraid of. So how do we do this transformation? If this is the pathway, if human transformation is the first step to cultural and societal transformation. The Earth has already traveled 26,000 miles through space, so I don't have a lot of time to go into this. But I do want to offer you two thoughts of how transformation can happen in our lives. And the first one is this: transformation can happen through suffering. Now, suffering is usually not something that we would choose. It's usually something that happens to us. And it can be a huge number of things. It can be the loss of a family member, the loss of a job, a humiliation at work, or sometime in our lives. Suffering, one sort of way to describe it would be a loss of control. Something's happened to us we haven't chosen, and it's painful, and it hurts. But it's a great opportunity for transformation. I started to actually prepare this talk 4 years ago. I can be slow at some things, but I'm not that slow at this. But 4 years ago, about this month, 4 years ago, I was going to give a talk along these lines, and I'd started to put some thoughts together on growth and transformation, suffering. And 4 days before I was due to give this talk, Lucy was pregnant at the time, and we lost her child through miscarriage. So here I was writing about this in a conceptual way, and bang, I was right in the midst of it. And just in case anyone's feeling a bit anxious about me saying that, Lucy was aware that I was going to mention that this morning. We'd been trying to have a child for 4 years up to that point, and that had been the third miscarriage. There was something about that one that just hit us really hard. It felt like a deep loss. And we suffered, and we grieved. But I think we also transformed. The next 6 months that followed that, we cleared our diaries. Anything that was we were doing on autopilot, we said no to. We spent lots of time together. We went for long walks on the beach, talking and crying. We got to know each other a lot better. We found out some of the deep longings and desires that we both had that we didn't know about before. And we faced a challenging question as a marriage, which was, are we okay if we don't have kids? And we were. It was a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing for me to know in my marriage that I'm enough. Now, that is not an uncommon story. I know there'll be many other people in this room who've suffered in the same way. But going through that suffering for us enabled us to transform. It increased our compassion for others going through the same thing. Suffering can be hard because I think it can get two reactions from others that aren't necessarily helpful. One is they take a wide berth because they don't want to say the wrong thing. And the other is they overcompensate with, it's going to be okay, you're going to be fine, you'll get through this, which isn't necessarily the best thing to hear when you're suffering. But we were fortunate at the time that we had friends who just sat with us in the dark, in the pain, and were there. Transformation can come through suffering, but we need each other in the midst of it. And the second thing I want to suggest, the second way that transformation can happen, is through contemplation, or we might call it contemplative prayer. And I found a great quote about this, which is Rowan Williams' address to the Synod of Bishops in Rome about 5 years ago. And he said, contemplation is an intrinsic element in this transforming process. To learn to look to God without regard to my own instant satisfaction, to learn to scrutinize and to relativize the cravings and fantasies that arise in me. This is to allow God to be God. Only as this begins to happen will I be delivered from treating the gifts of God as yet another set of things I may acquire to make me happy or to dominate other people. As this process unfolds, I become more free to love human beings in a human way, to love them not for what they may promise me, to love them not as if they were there to provide me with lasting safety and comfort, but as fragile fellow creatures held in the love of God. Contemplation is putting ourselves in a place where we're not in control. In some ways, it's very similar to suffering, and if you have tried contemplation, it can be like suffering, because we love distraction, we love entertainment, we love filling the time and space with things that keep us stimulated. Contemplation is recognizing that we're not the center of the universe. We're not in control. And it's recognizing that we can't think our way through change. We can't think our way through transformation. In 2 Corinthians 3:18, it says, as we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. So with unveiled faces, contemplate. I love that phrase, unveiled faces. It's coming to it as I am. I'm not putting on a mask. I'm not trying to be someone else. But I'm contemplating. I'm inviting the Spirit to come. So it's letting go of my power to experience the divine power. Letting go of my striving, of my ego, and trusting God to carry me through every season. So I asked you a question at the start. Have you still got your stones? And the question is, what season are you in? What season are you in? Is this a time of growth for you? Or death? Or maybe somewhere in between? We're going to share bread and wine in a moment, and what I'd like to do, I've got a poem that I'd like to read, and then we're just going to take a moment in silence, just to hold your stone and just ponder that question, what season are you in? And then I'd like to invite you to take the stone and just place it back in the pile where you find it, and then as you return back into the main auditorium to receive bread and wine, if you would like to do that. And these elements of bread and wine are, they just align exactly with what we've been talking about this morning. Because they are about this universal truth of transformation, of death and resurrection. And the invitation is to take up our cross. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not be hungry. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. So the deep longings and needs that we have, that we try and get them met by consuming and growing, Jesus is saying, I've got it all. It's all here. Right here, right now. So I'm going to read this poem, and then we'll just take some silence, and then just in your own time, and maybe I'll invite the band to, if they want to go first, so that they can have an opportunity to put their stone down and get bread and wine, that would be great, and then they can maybe play for us a bit. So this poem is called The Way to God, and it's actually by one of our family, one of our congregations, Simon Ray, Matthew's not here this morning. It's down and in, not up and out, this way to God. A sinking down, retreating, retracing, returning tenderly to inspect forgotten grottos, haunted caves with ancient markings of beasts, hunts, histories, genealogies, conquests and defeats, terrifying forms traced back in firelight. The ladder of the patriarch was not for Jacob's ascent, but a holy way down for angels grounded in divine. And the man God on the hill, headed home, made his ascent with his riven, punctured frame, his broken, betrayed heart, and dark soul known in dark.